This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. President John F. Kennedy set the nation's sights on the moon. 50 years later, President Barack Obama announced that neuroscience would be his signature scientific effort.
You know, as humans, we can identify galaxies light years away. We can study particles smaller than an atom, but we still haven't unlocked the mystery of the 3 pounds of matter that sits between our ears.
So the president has committed an initial $100 million to a project called BRAIN. Its goal is to research and develop more advanced tools to understand better how the human brain works.
That's the focus of a new weekly series launched today on WBUR. It's called Brain Matters, reporting from the frontiers of neuroscience. On Morning Edition today, WBUR's health and science reporter Carrie Goldberg offered an overview of what some call the beginning of a golden age of brain science. Among other things, it holds huge promise for the treatment of brain disorders like autism, mental illness, and dementia, which affect at least 1 billion people.
In a few minutes, we're going to talk about that with one of the world's leading neuroscientists. But first, here's an excerpt from Carrie's story about a series of new techniques and tools to unlock the mystery of the brain.
There's a host of other methods in the new brain toolbox: stem cells, computer science for big data, better brain imaging, and there's DNA. Researchers are pinpointing hundreds of genes that raise a person's risk of mental illness.
Many of the genes for serious mental illness, we're talking about discoveries in just the last year or two. Genes for schizophrenia, bipolar disease, depression, and so on, autism.
Robert Desimone directs the McGovern Institute for Brain Research at MIT.
This is absolutely hot off the press genetic information. So many labs are rushing in to try to understand these mutations.
Desimone says the goal is to build a bridge from the gene to its effects on the brain to the disorder. Where might that bridge lead? Imagine I'm a psychiatrist of the future, and instead of just telling you that you have major depression, I say, your genes and brain scans tell us that some of your neural connections are acting abnormally, and we have a targeted drug for just that problem. Or we can turn some of your skin cells into specific brain cells, edit out the disease genes in those cells, and then implant them to fix your faulty circuit.
And that's WBUR's Carrie Goldberg reporting on some of the ways the incredible advances in brain science could soon be used to treat mental illness. And we're going to talk a lot more about that now. And Carrie is with us now. Welcome to the program, Carrie. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Anthony. I don't know if I would say soon we'll be able to use those techniques, but way off in the future.
Way off in the future. All right. Well, thanks for that clarification. And we're going to talk and sort of bore down into this issue of genetics and treatment of mental illness. But first, a couple of general questions about this series. Why did President Obama, who we heard at the beginning of this segment, make this his administration's signature science project now?
Well, we seem to be seeing the convergence of two things. One is the growing understanding that the burden of brain disorders, when you put together mental illness, autism, dementia, Alzheimer's, is just possibly the heaviest health burden that there is on the world population. It's more than 1 billion people, and those costs are expected to grow and grow and grow, both in human suffering and in money. And then at the same time, we have this really amazing, exciting moment in neuroscience in which the scientists themselves are saying that they're gaining traction on the sort of brute complexity of the brain, and they're starting to be able to figure out what goes on with our billions of neurons and their trillions of connections.
So it's a real intersection between this growing healthcare need and the technology that is there to treat it possibly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, listeners, we welcome your questions about this fascinating subject. What questions do you have about the new frontiers of neuroscience? In particular, we're going to be talking now about how a better understanding of the brain could lead to better treatment for mental illness, whether it's autism, schizophrenia, or dementia. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And let me welcome Dr. Robert Desimone. He's a professor of neuroscience and director of the McGovern Institute of Brain Research at MIT. And Dr. Desimone, welcome to Radio Boston. Good to have you.
Well, thanks for having me here.
So some are calling this the most exciting time in history to be a neuroscientist. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. If I was a young person today deciding on what career I would be going into, neuroscience would be way up near the top of my list.
Yeah. And what makes it so? I mean, what's your description of why?
Well, it's, you know, it's, I guess you'd say it's like for the astronomers with the invention of the telescope. Mm. I mean, all of a sudden we have the ability to see things and brain activity we were never able to see before. The new genetic discoveries you had mentioned earlier have opened up our eyes to new possibilities for understanding and treating disease and so on. It's just incredible opportunities for someone coming into the field today.
In Carrie's piece, this what's interesting that you mentioned Galileo and the telescope, because in Carrie's piece this morning, a Brandeis neuroscientist said that brain research is much harder than, say, putting a man on the moon, because the moonshot was sort of this precise goal. But with the brain, the goal seems to be wide open. So I'm just wondering how wide open.
Well, some people describe, you know, getting to the moon as sort of an engineering problem. Mm. There wasn't any unknown principle of science that we had to figure out in order to be able to get there. Whereas with the brain, there are still unknown unknowns. There are still the things that we don't even know we don't know. And so there will be new principles of biology discovered as we understand more about the brain.
That's really interesting. So let's talk unknown unknowns. We've heard that in another context, but we don't have to in a few years ago, but we don't have to go into that. It's a great expression, though. So let's talk about this really exciting idea about using the latest advances in brain science to one day treat mental illness more effectively. And in Carrie's piece, we heard you talking about this idea that many of the genes for serious mental illness have only just been discovered in the last year or so. So what's the potential there?
Well, I think there's a number of approaches that are going to be followed. One, some people are going to be pursuing gene therapy, where you'd actually go in and try to correct some genetic defects. Other people are going to be pursuing the new leads that the genetic insights give us into altered neural circuits. Because in the end, genes themselves don't cause bad feelings or bad thoughts. Genes only act on all the neurons in our brain. And in the end, it's all the neurons that are involved in our behavior and so on. And so in the end, we will need to alter those neural circuits in order to correct some of the behavioral problems people have had.
So I need a little more. So, you know, I heard Carrie say in her piece that the goal is to build a bridge from the gene to the effects on the brain to the disorder. So where does that bridge lead us? I mean, does it lead us to new treatments, new psychiatric treatments, new drugs, all of the above?
All of the above.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, just as in all areas of medicine, you want behavioral approaches, there'll be therapy will continue to play an important role. If I have heart disease, I might take medications, but I might also have an exercise program. Mm. It's going to be the same thing in neuroscience. You know, you're going to need a comprehensive approach if people have a serious brain disorder. Mm.
Is understanding the genetics of things like autism, dementia, other serious mental illness, is that tantamount to a cure? I mean, are we moving down that road?
Yes, I really wish it were the case that just identifying the genes would right away lead into the cure, because it's not the case that it's a starting point. You know where the path begins, but now we have the hard work ahead of us to understand how those genetic changes again lead to alterations in how our neural circuits are working, how our memory system works, how our prefrontal cortex is planning out the future and so on, and then only then will we be able to come back in with new therapies that are going to correct some of these problems. Mm.
And how far away are we for new effective therapies? You know, I think I used the word soon. Carrie corrected me and said, maybe not so soon. What's the sort of the correct, what are the correct parameters here?
Well, you know, I've always said that I expect major new treatments in my lifetime. Of course, I do expect to live a long time. I think rather than giving ourselves a goal for we'll have a new treatment by this year, I'd like to see intermediate goals. I'd like to see us a good model system for creating new therapies. You know, the kinds of model systems we have now are not that great. But I think within 5 years, if we don't have a much better model systems for some serious disorders like schizophrenia, bipolar disease, for example, I will be really disappointed if we can't meet a goal like that.
So 5 years. I mean, that's incredibly hopeful for people out there, for folks with loved ones, family members who are struggling with these disorders. Carrie.
And Anthony, just to clarify, what do you mean by model system? Do you mean in a dish, like mental illness in a dish? Do you mean in an animal? Because it's been really hard to replicate mental illnesses in animals.
Well, all of the above. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a lot of approaches that, we and others are following in terms of creating some aspects of the biochemical underpinnings of brain disorders in a dish. There is some frustration with how mouse models have gone. You know, lots of mouse models have led to ideas for new therapies that when you go into human beings have not worked out in clinical trials. It's been very frustrating for us. Now with the new technology for genome editing, where we can actually go in and using technology developed by Feng Zhang and George Church and others, we can go in and edit the DNA. And that allows us not only the potential of editing the DNA in people, but editing the DNA in more advanced animals. It could be, for example, small monkeys might be a better model, and that's something that we're actively pursuing.
Listeners, what questions do you have about this new frontier in neuroscience? In particular, we're talking about how a better understanding of the brain could lead to better treatments for mental illness, whether it's autism, schizophrenia, dementia. Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Dr. Robert Desimone. He's a professor of neuroscience at MIT and health and science reporter here at WBUR, Carrie Goldberg. Dr. Desimone, I'd love to take a couple of calls. We've got some people standing by. Sarah is calling from Milford. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. My question has to do with dementia and actually kind of concomitant dementia. My father has what's called Parkinson's Plus, so he has dementia on top of his Parkinson's. And one of the things we've had the hardest trouble treating is some, you know, like paranoia and, you know, sociopathic kind of issues for him and, you know, not understanding where he is or who he's with and things like that. And so my questions are, and I know that some of that actually comes from his Parkinson's medication. So I guess my question is, has there been any progress in one understanding Parkinson's related dementia better and any kind of new therapies for that? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank All you. Right. Thank you, Sarah, for the question.
Well, I can't comment on your father's very specific condition, but I can tell you that there's a much greater understanding now that Parkinson's disease affects more than just the dopaminergic cells that are involved in the control of movement. You know, that was the focus for the beginning. People can't move. People, you know, have no control of their limbs. That's the obvious one, right? But now we're understanding that's right. And many people suffering from Parkinson's disease, there are other cognitive results from that, sometimes depression, sometimes confusion, sometimes a mild dementia in the advanced stages of the disease. And so we are identifying some of the other biological players in some of these other symptoms of the disease.
Thank you so much for that call, Carrie. Kathleen is calling from Andover. Kathleen, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am wondering how these developments will impact the treatment of addiction, and will they have any different paths for those who are just found to be genetically predisposed or to those who find themselves already, you know, thrust into the battle of addiction full swing?
Really interesting question, Kathleen.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question about the genetic basis for addiction, because actually there's a if you're married, your spouse is more likely, for example, to be a smoker if you are than your children. In other words, there's a greater association between people who marry each other than, say, what you might pass down to a child in terms of genetics. So there's a very heavy environmental component in addictions. On the other hand, there may be genetic propensities to becoming addicted if you have access to those addictive substances, including nicotine. So I think genetics will play a role, but I'm actually more excited about some of the other things that we're finding out in neuroscience about the neural circuits involved in addiction. And even without having a genetic target, we may be able to target some of those neural circuits and help people get off those addictions more easily than we have today by sort of targeting circuits and letting them relieve themselves, basically, from these sort of addictive cycles.
So does that, if I can just sort of understand what we, you know, what that would actually mean, are we talking about sort of shutting down certain neural circuits that cause us to have addictive cravings?
I think what people are understanding is that it's sort of like a vicious cycle, that you have the brain's natural reward centers get activated by these addictive drugs, and then So people feel good afterwards. But then there's a crash, and it goes negative. So then when people aren't taking the drug, there's a craving to get back into that state. Mm. So we need something that can go in there and break that cycle so that we don't have these, the ups and downs and people going back again to take those addictive substances.
I have a question, and I'm not sure. A question about sort of genetic predisposition to certain disorders, and I'm just wondering if there's a complicated side to all this. If we get to the point where we can really understand this, I mean, let's consider someone with a child who was tested at a very young age and found to be genetically predisposed with a heightened risk for schizophrenia, for example. Would that automatically lead to treatment before symptoms even present themselves? Does this get us into a sort of murky terrain that's a little bit complicated to understand about, okay, we've got the information, now what do we do?
Right. Many people feel that prevention will in some ways be a more effective approach for a lot of brain disorders than trying to fix damage after it occurs. Alzheimer's disease, for example, you definitely want to get in there and try to prevent these neurons from dying in the disease than trying to put the brain back together after you've already had a lot of significant neural damage. Something like schizophrenia, it's not clear there's a neurodegenerative component to it, but nonetheless, if there's a process that we know starts in early childhood, and if you could interrupt that process before someone reaches adolescence and starts developing symptomatology in their early 20s, that could be, very powerful.
Mm. Carrie, this is such big and complex and fascinating stuff. You posed an interesting question, though, in your piece this morning, and this idea that as we learn more and more and more about the brain and how the brain functions, we get to this really tantalizing question: can the brain really understand the brain?
Right. It's one of the ultimate mysteries of life. And I think I'm misquoting here, but there's something like if the brain could understand itself, it wouldn't be smart enough to do it, right? Is that how it's
Well,
said?
I know some people worry that we're not smart enough to understand our own brains. But I got to tell you one thing that's a little surprising is that actually people have been getting smarter over the years. There's actually a lot of evidence worldwide that intelligence has been going up. And people have a lot of hypotheses for why that is. But there's no actually settled explanation for it. Kids today are smarter than they were when I was a kid.
Mm. though we might not understand every single question that the brain poses, just the effort in trying to understand it will make us smarter.
Well, that could well be. The other thing is, today all scientists are making use of very powerful computer systems and software for understanding all the data that's coming out of the brain. So our own brains are aided by all the tools that we developed in science in general. Again, very powerful computers and software. Crunching through all the data that we get out of the brain is making it easier for us to understand how the brain's working.
Really fascinating stuff. I think we've got time for at least one more call. Rob is calling from Weymouth. Rob, you're on the air.
Hi. I didn't hear the whole discussion, so this may have already been talked about, but I'm a cardiac electrophysiologist, and in the history of dealing with cardiac arrhythmias, which are electrochemical disorders, just like in the brain, the original history was medicines, and medicines are horrible because they affect every cell in the body. So you affect every cell in the body for the problem in a very small area. And their actions are very unpredictable. With heart rhythms, they either make them better, do nothing, or make them worse. And now what's completely taken over, almost completely, is ablation, where you put a catheter in the heart and you find the few hundred cells that are causing the problem. You send a little energy through the catheter, it heats up the tip, and you are cured without having these circulating medicines that have unpredictable effects on every part of the body. And as time goes on, fewer and fewer medicines are used for rhythm disturbances and more ablation. But that depends on an understanding of the anatomy of the heart. The anatomy of the brain is so much more complicated. There was a trial at MGH doing ablation for intractable, untreatable, obsessive compulsive disorder, using ablation of certain areas, and in individual patients, it was incredibly successful.
Rob, thanks so much. I followed just about everything you said. You spoke in a really interesting way, but Dr. DeSimone, I'd love you to comment on what Rob said. I mean, just sort of the potential there for these kinds of therapies to circumnavigating the need for medicine.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point, and there are definitely parallels to what's going on in brain research now with what he just described in terms of cardiac care. There are people have brain implants in Parkinson's disease and severe depression, obsessive compulsive disorder was just mentioned, and where those stimulating electrodes can relieve a lot of the symptoms that people have. And these are electrodes in highly specific brain circuits. But so those, right now, those require electrodes implanted in the brain. But now we have tools for stimulating neurons with light. So with lasers, you can stimulate neurons. And right now, they do require an invasive implant. But people are looking in the future, it may be as light that could come from outside the head. And you might be able to target those specific neural populations non-invasively. And so people are looking at basically just wild new ideas for what could be the therapies of the future.
Wait, how does the light get through your head?
Wild new ideas and hopeful ideas. Carrie, this is just week one of the Brain Matters series. What are you going to be focusing on in week two?
We will be going on to dyslexia and how dyslexia seems to be the learning disorder that is gaining the most benefit so far from neuroscience research. It's amazing how early it can be detected using brain scans.
All right. Carrie Goldberg, WBUR health and science reporter and co-host of our Common Health blog. Thank you, as always.
You're welcome.
And Dr. Robert DeSimone, director of the McGovern Institute for Brain Research at MIT. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me here.
And you can find a link to Carrie's story from this morning, as well as a lot more information about our series at RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, a husband-wife New Hampshire-based rock duo whose lead singer's day job is very different from her rock and roll life. I'm Anthony Brooks with Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.